The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Well, there goes the Daverhood. Welcome, everybody, to the 127th edition of Dave's Gone By, an hour of smart talk, silly talk, special talk, and music. Last week, my special guest in the Daverhood was new wave musician Reckless Eric, truly one of the founders of the whole post-punk sound, along with his Stiff Records label mates Elvis Costello, Ian Dury, and Nick Lowe. And for a couple of years in the late 70s, Reckless Eric was a pretty major force in that genre. But then times changed the scene, and alcohol changed Eric. And after a period of rebuilding, he went back to the music, and he's been making it ever since. Last year, his autobiography, A Dysfunctional Success, was published in the UK, and he's got a new CD out called Bungalow High on the Southern Domestic label. And we talked a bit about his career last week, but we got sidetracked by all sorts of things, including subways, Coney Island, and Jewish musicians. It was hilarious. It was a blast. But there's so much more to talk about, so Reckless Eric returns tonight to Dave's Gone By. We've got the whole hour, sponsored by Hewlett Minuteman Press, The Copy Kings, and Total Theater, publishers of Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. And it's hosted by me, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, journalist, humorist, and reckless oracle. And we're not even going to go to commercial. We're just going to get right back to the interview with Eric Goulden, a.k.a. Reckless Eric. Tell everybody that you do have a really, really cool website where they can find out about you, about all your CDs and all the stuff you're doing.
I doubt if anyone can find out anything much from my website, but I think it is quite cool in a way. It's recklesseric.com.
Oh, sure. That's easy. And it's reckless with a W.
Of course it is, yeah.
Well, you know, not everybody may remember.
But anyway, that's why I got the name Reckless Eric, because I was going to put this, we were putting this record out, which was called Whole Wide World, and I had to have a name, and I was just someone who was around the Stiff thing, and then I was probably going to make a record under another name after that. You know, I mean, I figured that it didn't matter what you called yourself, you know, you'd make a record under one name and then under another, and then it would be really throwaway, because that was part, I suppose, of that kind of part of the original punk ethos, was that, like, it would make it, you'd make the music more disposable, more trashy. Because we're talking about, I don't know what it was like over here, but over there we were talking about a scene that encompassed, like, Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Genesis. And
we had disco, man. I mean, that's what we had.
Disco's great, but disco was homemade in the first place. You know, I think disco is much maligned. Now everyone's turned the radio off.
Now it was maligned, and now people who hated it understand that there was, at its best, the same with every other kind of music, including rap to Hawaiian steel guitar. You know, there's one percentage that's cream that's really exceptional.
Yeah.
But there was just so much else, and was on every other radio station, that there had to be a backlash, because you couldn't listen to the radio without hearing 20 minutes of one beat, whistles, and that was the song. And that's why they would, you know, blow up LPs in the middle of Yankee Stadium saying yes to disco. Anyway, but yeah, we were rebelling, and you had Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Genesis, Yes, Supertramp.
Oh God!
And all this stuff, and it was so high flown, it was so precious, it was all so expensive. You know, big production kind of stuff. Emerson, Lake and Palmer with three trucks, and they showed a film of it once on the telly, and like on the television, and the trucks had like the letters ELP, one on each,
I remember that,
articulated truck, you know. I think it was a revolt against, because there we are, You left school. There was nothing you could do. Like, it was getting difficult to get jobs in England. We had no future.
No future, right.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Sex Pistols and all that. Were they first, or were they...
The Pistols, I first heard about the Pistols, I think, in 75. And, like, that was all... Because, like, I used to look quite a lot like Johnny Rotten, really.
Like,
it was very surprising to see it. In the first place, someone said, "Yeah, have you seen this?" It was in the NME, the New Musical Express. "Have you seen this bloke? Look, he looks like you."
Hmm.
And it was very odd. And like, they were doing a lot of the same songs as us. There was something in the air, because the same thing, we're doing this thing in Hull, and then in Manchester there was like the Buzzcocks and stuff, and they were doing the same kind of thing. Cheap guitars, cheap little amplifiers, really scratchy sound and everything. It's the same as what we were doing. And it was the same as what was happening in London. There was something in the air.
Now, I might as well ask you, and again, forgive me if this is the kind of question that you've been asked 4 million times, but if you've already answered it 4 million times, then 4 million and one won't hurt you, will it?
Oh.
But have to know, like, some of the people that you either were on a bill with or knew or met, any memories of John Lydon or Sid Vicious or that group? I mean, personal.
No, I was terrified of them. I wasn't anywhere near them, you know. Yeah. I mean, I was always an admirer of the Clash. And, yeah, Strummer liked my stuff, too.
So, did you have any kind of friendship with Joe Strummer or Mick Jones? Did you?
I've always been mates with their road manager, who was a man called Johnny Green.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another potential Jewish person there, maybe. But
my man's real name's John Broad.
Oh, no. No.
No. I don't know. He's from Kent. He's got a mouthful of broken teeth, and he's built like a wardrobe.
Ah. Definitely not Jewish. Okay.
I don't know.
but okay, he's a good friend, has been a friend. Yeah.
And, like, you know, I mean, everybody, I think as you in that time, it's like everyone thinks that everybody was real big mates, and that I never saw anybody. I mean, like, I was out touring all the time, and I suppose they were as well.
Well, I thought maybe you might have all been on gigs at the same time or opening. No,
I mean, I worked a lot with Ian Dury.
Wow, okay.
When before Ian made the album New Boots and Panties, that sort of, in 77, that sort of almost literally rocketed him to stardom or whatever it did, he was my drummer. So Ian played the drums with me, and he produced the B-side of my first single, which was a track called Semaphore Signals.
Semaphore Signals, great.
I live up here on this hill. She lives down there in the green belt. Her parents don't like me cause I come from a hill. They look at future if in doubt. I got no money to buy her. Her parents expect nothing less. But at night on the cover of darkness, she sneaks out to redeem my S.O.S. I'm saving semaphore signals. I'm up all night sending signals, tapping out love in Morse code. Forever trying new angles, keeping in touch on a string telephone. Messages of love to the green bell, from a semaphore lover on the hill. They're gonna hear some wedding bells, but till then I'll be standing by my window sill. I'm sending semaphore signals to the crane bell.
messages of love down to her house. Semaphore signals across enemy lines. Semaphore signals that bring tears to my eyes. I'm sending semaphore signals to the green belt. Semaphore signals down to her house. Semaphore signals across enemy lines. Semaphore signals that bring tears to my eyes.
And Ian was the drummer on it.
I did not know that he was doing that. And then he, because as unlikely in a way as you would be, no offense, to have been a rock star kind of performer, Ian Dury even more so, from the way he spoke, this working class.
You know. Also, as a drummer, he said, always wanted to be a drummer. Stupid when half your body don't work. Which is right, you know, because he had polio, so he had one side of his body was underdeveloped. He had a leg iron, and he had a sort of withered arm. And so there was only his right arm and his right leg that worked. So the sound was always really very... The drumming was very minimal. He used to do great things with his bass drum, and he used to work the hi-hat really well, but he had the hi-hat clamped shut, and he'd be playing these great rhythms on the hi-hat, and then his left leg was doing nothing, and he used to sort of lift his right arm up and kind of drop it onto the snare drum, and that was the snare. And then he had all these cymbals that he used to play funny bits on, but always the bass drum and the hi-hat.
Wow.
And his bass drum was great. And he was an absolute pig to work with. He used to shout at us all the time because it was my group, but he was in charge.
Now, this is... You know, I
mean, he was great. I can say that with absolute love and everything.
Well, because he's dead, yeah.
Yeah, he's dead now, but he was a very, very good friend of mine. You know, I loved him to bits and not...
Because I had gotten the feeling, and it was one of the questions I had going to ask, that all the people in that stable... I had gotten the feeling, certainly over the years, that...
It's more of a sty than a stable.
Yeah, exactly, that you weren't all very nice people then, but Ian Dury seemed like he might be the nicest.
No,
but
he was the most monstrous.
I think
he was the most obviously monstrous. I think the most monstrous, really, was probably Elvis Costello.
Well, that I figured.
Is this kind of very... ambitious songwriting machine type monster personage. Ian hated him.
Was it professional jealousy or was Costello being a jerk?
I think it was a professional thing, really. But Ian didn't differentiate, really.
Well, how did you feel about Elvis? In those days, you know? Indifferent, really.
I was terribly impressed that he could sort of, like, you know, I mean, like, in the time it took most people to go to the toilet, he could write a song. I was terribly impressed that he could do that, but I wasn't really touched by a lot of what he did. His first album didn't really bother me. The second one kind of sounded exciting.
I mean, we have to, for folks at home who may not be into that music or, because we have a very, very wide audience. We're talking about two very important rock and roll albums here, this year's Model and My Aim Is True. Actually, I reversed them, but so, I mean, that's the thing. You were coming to it from a perspective, he was another mate from that stable, and I wasn't, the rest of the world now thinks.
I used to like The Damned. The Damned, their first album was monumental. I think that was actually the first, if you like, punk album to be released.
And that really made an impression.
It's really exciting. I don't know about anything else. I never really got off on much else that they'd done. But that's probably because I didn't have time to listen to it. But that first album was remarkable. It still is.
And when you started then getting into the whole... I will call it a scene at that point. We were on Stiff Label and all these folks.
We went on tour. Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe, Ian Dury, me, Larry Wallace.
Right.
Dave Edmonds came with us and whatever. Yeah, it was suddenly like I went from playing in kind of working men's clubs and like little bars and like in the hall at the art school up in Hull to playing in front of like 1,000 or 1,500 people a night.
Wow.
I like finding it quite confusing. I think I had to do it. I had to learn how to do it in public.
Did success, such as it was, change you? I mean, did you physically feel yourself like, so first you were playing in pubs, and then within a year, if the limousine was late, well, I thought
no,
it was a limousine kind
limousine
of track.
It was, none of that, but no, I think, like, suddenly, obviously, I could afford to, I had a drink problem anyway, really, although I didn't realise it was a problem at the time, but...
did it start before
even
were signed? It was
absolutely. Yeah. Like, art schools were very hard drinking places in those days.
Why did you turn to that?
I think it accelerated, the problem accelerated, because suddenly I could afford to buy bottles of vodka and stuff like that, and I was around, I was around people who took lots of things and drank lots of whatever, everything was going on. I mean, it was proper sex, drugs, rock and roll, alcohol kind of.
Yeah. I mean, the CD that I have the old LP of Big Smash with that wonderful cover and stuff, but the one CD I've had of yours until today, thank you, is the Live Skips, which is all of you again on that tour, and you sound wrecked. You were wrecked, Eric.
I did actually have laryngitis. I got a flu during that tour. It didn't make it better, probably because I was completely run down from the abuse, really. It was not good, really. Got more sorted out. I mean, I was able to tour for a long time without getting ill eventually. But
well, when another, so those were the really huge, exciting years for that whole thing.
I got very famous very quick. It was too much too soon, really. You need time. It's like there was a time. It was the beginning of another era in music. I think in the '70s, like labels like Island Records, when they started, they would figure that they'd make an album, a first album with a band, and like, they would send them away to somewhere where they could get themselves together, and then they'd make an album. They wouldn't worry that it was going to lose money. And they would put them out on a bit of gentle touring to see how they got on and everything, and then they would make a second album and aim to break even, and then aim to make a profit with the third album.
That's actually much gently... First I've heard say... put things in a nice way from the record company perspective, where they're really trying to put out they're taking the risk, they're spending the money, and the likelihood, even without funny accounting, of breaking even on the first one or two is very unlikely. I mean, you hear mostly artists say, the record companies are awful, and they sign you to these horrible deals right from the start.
They probably are now. There were a few that cared, I think, in the 70s, and then it got to... We were getting to this point where everyone wanted an immediate success, and if it wasn't successful, they'd get another one and throw that one away. No.
Were Stiffs like that? Or what happened with Stiffs?
Eventually, it stopped. It very quickly, after that Stiff tour, after the classic first Stiff tour, the two partners split. Jake Riviera, who managed Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe, he took them away. And Dave Robinson, who was the other half, managed Graham Parker and The Rumour, who weren't on Stiff, and he had Ian Dury, and he had me, and he had the Damned. I could have gone with Jake, but somehow I made a—I don't know, one way or another.
Well, it isn't necessarily the wrong. It's just it's a different choice.
I don't know. Jake once said that maybe he should have taken me with him, and he regretted that he hadn't, because like I didn't get treated very well.
Oh.
But I did say at the time, well, you know, don't feel bad because I probably would have screwed it up anyway.
Because you were still
yeah.
a mess.
Yeah.
How did you stop being a mess?
Oh, that.
Or are you still?
No. I actually stopped drinking. I've been sober and everything for 19 and a half years.
May I wish you a mazel tov on that? That's American talk. Congratulations on that. Was it AA or what did you do?
Bit of AA and I can't imagine. I can't begin to explain. It take too long. I knew, after I think I was 12 years of hard abuse, and I either had to die or change it.
And you did change it. I mean, were you near death or?
Yeah, several times. Yeah.
Man, and were you still writing and recording up to that point, or?
I left Stiff Records. I made 3-4 albums altogether. I think for Stiff. But Stiff changed into a different company almost like in 78. From the beginning of 78, Stiff started to turn into this other. Kind of monster, like a real record company that expected instant results of its artists and had funny accounting and people. The thing is, when we started with Stiff, like the whole thing was like we were laughing at all the proper record companies.
How did you do? I mean, when you came through all that, and okay, not counting all the money that you probably. You know, pissed away on liquor. Was there funny money or were you okay? I mean, were you making a decent or a great living?
No, not really. I was on £50 a week all through the Stiff thing, which like now it's like, well, you can't equate it to now. £50 a week would just get you through, really.
Barely, yeah.
I mean, it paid the rent and, then, of course, I got a bit of money from the PRS, which is an English society that collects radio revenue. And eventually the publishers, who was Zomba Music, they accounted to me, and I got more money than I could dream of having, which wasn't actually a lot of money, which I probably drank away and invested in, like, bands that, in between, like, because the money came after I'd left Stiff, really. But by the time that Stiff was doing bands like the Bell Stars and that really in Madness and all that, I couldn't relate to that. It's all well in its place, you know, and it's okay. But
the scene was over. That moment was
yeah,
gone.
Yeah, because what happened, suddenly Stiff became like, it became for a little while, for a short while, it was the grooviest record label in the world. And so everyone wanted to work for it. So, of course, all these people from other record labels came and started working for it. And they were the labels that we'd been laughing at. And suddenly, from being on the side of poking fun at these people and getting up their noses and screwing them one way or another, turning their world on its head, we were suddenly in their world.
Well, isn't that with every
generation? Won't get fooled again by The Who, which I think is the greatest record ever made, and at the end, meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Right. And you look in the mirror, and that boss sometimes turns out to be you. That's the
So I left that, and I kind of spent time in the wilderness, if you like. I sort of wandered around trying to get a record deal and couldn't because not everyone knew that I was a drunk. I don't know, but I was writing songs. I wrote some good stuff at the time, which I later recorded.
So there was never a question of giving up music entirely. I mean, it came out of it.
At one point, I worked for a country singer from North Carolina called George Hamilton IV, And I was his sound engineer when he toured in England. He was very successful in England. He's probably not successful over here.
We have a different George Hamilton. He's like a guy who tans a lot and acts in movies.
Yeah, that one, yeah. No, George Hamilton the Fourth. He had a hit in the 50s with a song called A Rose and a Babe Ruth.
Yeah, okay.
I worked for him. Moved out of London, moved down to Kent, and I moved to the Medway.
Okay.
The Medway is Chatham, Medway, what they call the Medway Delta, Chatham, Gillingham, Rochester, it's where Wild Billy Childish comes from. That, there's a whole garage scene there.
Huh.
I suppose that saved my life. No, it didn't save my life, actually. It probably put me back creatively years, because eventually I got involved in that. But before that, I was with a label called Go Disc, Billy Bragg and all that.
Oh, okay, yeah.
House Martins and everything. And I made an album for them, but we didn't get on, really. I could never take the continuing hypocrisy. They're supporting the miners' strike and saying that everybody is, you know, we're a socialist record label, but they're walking around in Armani suits.
Well, if everyone has an Armani suit, that's socialism.
Cool, yeah.
If all of them have the same pair of shoes, then, you know, they're all making it to the Ben and Jerry's quote, you know.
I got caught reading The Sun, which is one of those English newspapers that's fairly right-wing.
Yeah.
And I got caught reading it and was told I mustn't read it. And so I'm too old for people to tell me what I must and must not read. And anyway, don't you want to know what 6 million people have dropping onto their doormat every morning? You know, people read this. I want to read it. I want to know what they're thinking.
You are a reader. I can see that. And you're a writer as well.
Yeah, I wrote a book, yes.
Well, it's called
A Dysfunctional Success.
And is that the story of your life?
Yeah, it's my autobiography. Unfortunately, they won't, the publishers can't seem to get anything going to get it published over here.
Well, you are doing gigs, though. I mean, it's not as if you're just sort of visiting here with your girlfriend. You play.
I do, yeah. I've been taking it on, yeah. I did a residency at the Knitting Factory in New York.
Cool.
Which I've just finished, so you can't go and see me there.
Right.
I've played at the South by Southwest Festival, and I did Maxwell's in Hoboken.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good place.
Will you be coming back to East over the summer, let's say, or late spring?
Maybe I'll come back and do some shows in June, and then again in the fall.
And are people receptive to the new material, or do they expect, like, you know, Reconnaissery?
No, because there's a whole load. Well, you know, I went underground from 82 when I left Stiff. Like, I was just, or 81, I think it may have been. It took some time. I made my last record for them in 1980, and it took some time to extricate myself from the label.
Right.
And I went underground. I had a band with two members of Ian Dury's old band, the Blockheads.
Right.
And that's, we did this album for Go Disc. And then after that, I was in a band in the Medway, based in the Medway in Kent, in England, a band called the Lembrite Combo. And we made two albums that are very, in England, we got quite successful.
Oh, cool.
But on a smaller level, we used to play in clubs rather than big university halls and, like, town halls and things like that. We played in clubs.
But you can make a living doing that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we almost did.
Almost.
And then I moved at the end of the 80s. I mean, I'd given up drinking in 85. And eventually that got traumatic. I don't think I did it the right way. I stopped going to AA, and I had a nervous breakdown.
How do you know when you have a nervous breakdown?
I think it becomes apparent to other people first, because you start acting a bit strange. I mean, when you start shouting at passers-by and stuff like that, it starts to become more obvious, and it becomes more and more obvious as your life completely falls to pieces.
Wow. And you know you're sort of over it when...
When
the medication kicks in?
No. Actually, I did have to go to hospital, but I did the sensible thing, which is, by accident, I managed to admit myself to hospital before I was sectioned, which meant that I didn't have to have the medication. I've refused all medication, and I got better a lot quicker, I think, than if I'd had medication.
And if you had been forced to go there, they could have given you...
They would have given me everything and put me under, and I would have ended up like in the system. And once you're in that system, it's very hard to get out of it, right. I think. And there are a lot of people that are...
Any people from the old days of your...
Yeah, meet anybody I knew.
Not necessarily famous, but yeah.
Well, I know that Viv Stanshaw used to go to the same hospital as me when he, on occasions, who, of course, played with Neil
yeah.
Innes in Bonzo Dog Band. Yes, there was a member of one of Ian Dury's bands who used to pop in and out of there on a regular basis, apparently, but I never met him while I was in there. I didn't actually meet anyone I knew while I was in there.
When, in the old days, I mean, you certainly said you envied Elvis Costello, because he was basically like a song machine.
I didn't envy him at
all.
All
right,
actually.
But you were...
I wondered how he did it. I mean, I found it quite impressive that he just could...
But you were penning a lot of stuff then, too. I mean, you know, you had a double album, and that happened very... You were pretty prolific, and I'm kind of wondering if...
I didn't think I was. I mean, like, they used to tell me off for everything at Stiff. You know, that was part of the... They always used to tell me I wasn't successful. Dave Robinson said I was his Achilles heel. He could have a hit with anything, but he couldn't have a hit with me. And I thought, well, I don't want to have a hit record. I figured something out. Well, like, if you become a one-hit wonder and you have a hit record, like a big hit record, that's you. And that can be a choice. I mean, I know Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky. Yeah. Apparently, that's his set. He plays it for 45 minutes and then comes back on and does it again for the encore.
That's brilliant, though.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of groove that you could do that. He tried playing his other stuff, but no one really wanted to know. They just wanted to hear Spirit in the Sky. And I figure that's someone who's made it work for them.
What if you had to be the one who had to tease Reckon A. Cherie out to 45 minutes or Semaphore Signals or whatever?
Yeah, those. The Whole Wide World would be it, I suppose. Or over here, it might be Take the Cash.
Take it right. Actually, you wouldn't have been a one-hit one. You would have been like a 4, 5, or 7-hit wonder.
Yeah, but they were never big chart hits, and that was what was wanted. That's what they wanted in England. They wanted to have a chart hit. And I don't think my heart was in it, really. I thought it was a joke, chart hits. I mean, you know, you'd watch Top of the Pops, and it'd be the Police and bands like that. And who wants to be on a show with people like that?
Is your songwriting different, though, now? Or how is it, or is your process different?
I don't know, because I've never actually figured out how you do it. I wish I could, actually. I'd write more stuff if I did. I have to be under some kind of pressure to make another record. I have to have a reason to do it. I can't just do it because that's what I do. Because I also had this kind of crisis about it at the end of the 90s, where I think, it's like pollution, all these people writing these disgusting songs, and they write songs about relationships and stuff, and they say, then you see all these singer-songwriters and like some of the gigs that I was doing around that time, I've watched these singer-songwriter people that do the support opening acts, and they go, this is another song about a relationship, and you go, oh no, I don't want to know about that.
Unless it's a relationship between them and their goat and their washing machine, then it gets kind of...
Now that's more like it, yeah. But all these... I mean, people have a strange concept of songs, you know. I mean, if I told someone, I was telling you about the Coney Island trip to Coney Island and, like, going on the Big Dipper and that, and, like, someone might say, you could write a song, there's a song in that, and I think, what, a song about going on, you know, people have this concept that they're about this in very bland terms, very black and white, two-dimensional terms, but they're not. It's not quite like that.
Talking with Reckless Eric here in the neighborhood on Dave's Gone By, and just having this marvelous conversation. And then just want to sidetrack for a moment before we forget that he's got an album out, aside from the book that's published in England. He's got an album that's available here. And
just about available here, but...
Southern Domestic, yeah.
Yeah, so well, Southern Domestic is my own label, and we're licensing it over here. But it is available on import, at least.
All right, and again, also through your website?
It's on all the mail order outlets have got it. But this is part of what I've been saying about, like, that's my first album for 5 years. Because, like, I did have this crisis about how do you carry on writing songs in the face of more and more and more of the same stuff.
Right.
So how do I move forward?
And what was your answer to that? As you say, was it the techno thing, or was it just ignoring everything?
Ignore everything. Like mix up techno with songwriting, with like folk music, with free jazz, with bubblegum, with like whatever you want to do, and it. I figured by the time I made that, nobody wants to know. Nobody is sort of like battering my door down saying, where's your new album? No, there's a handful of people who want to know. And I figured, well, it would be a shame if I alienated them, but it won't be the end of the world because, you know, there's not a million people who are waiting for a new album. So it's not the... So...
Well, but maybe a quarter of a million. Possibly.
I wish there were.
All right, well, you know, a quarter of a quarter million. But some of the songs on here include Bungalow High and Lady Power, Magnificent Party, and what's the one that's kind of getting some attention?
The one that everyone likes is 33s and 45s, which is like, it's kind of misunderstood, really. They say that it's the breakup of a relationship.
Uh-oh, there's that relationship word. Yeah.
Yeah, they say, you know, all that kind of thing documented in records. I don't know, they say all kinds of rubbish about it, but it's just like, you always, if you're a musician or if you're into music, like most of the people I know are really into music, so the record collectors, I just know loads of nerdy record collectors, really.
Hello,
like,
yes.
Anything that happens to you, like, I think you tend to sort of, like, this is your reference is always your record collection. I can document anything that happened in my life. I can come back to it. I can go, now what record was out? What was I playing? What was I listening to at the time? And that album just came out. I remember, you know, because I was...
Yeah, I mean, I'm a geeky record collector and CD collector now.
And if you look at the records and listen to the records, you can remember exactly where you are. Yeah. Where you were at that time.
Well... Hopefully folks will go out and buy the new Reckless Eric album. It's called Bungalow High, and they'll maybe remember 10 or 20 or 30 years from now where they were or what they were doing or where America was like when the song 33s and 45, was that a good segue or what, came out.
It was almost slick, but I couldn't quite follow it. But I've screwed it up now.
And by the way, I should mention that the version on the CD is about 7.5 minutes long and also has some naughty bits in it that we can't play. So I'm going to play a radio edit of it. But if you want to hear the whole thing, You're going to get the CD.
I bought the CD. And it was called an LP again.
I wish it were the size of it. Remember the cool covers? Yeah.
Do I remember them? I still have them, you know. Yeah. Just that you can't release them now because apparently no one wants them except all the people I know.
And the audiophiles, you know, the big bands will still put out, like a Bob Dylan or a U2 will put out an LP in a very limited run because they can, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
and they sit in the record shops for years,
right,
like getting the corners getting destroyed, you know, because no one wants them.
Right. Do you frequent the radio, the few LP shops that are in the village around here still, and you check them out?
I do, yes, I do spend time, money in record shops. It's disgraceful.
No, I'll be doing that until I'm like 90.
I bought a Staples Singers album on Stax. It was just the greatest hits, but it was on the Stax label. It was an original Stax. I bought the Inflated Tear by Roland Kirk.
Okay.
I bought a copy of that, like vinyl. That's just the other day.
All right, so you're looking for a certain, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, something's come up, and I bought what I think is possibly a bootleg of King Tubby.
I do not know. King Tubby, yeah.
Studio One, Jamaican
reggae
type dub. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yes, if people knew what I was into, they'd be appalled.
Well, let's get into 33s and 45s.
I came back when you left and cleared up after you. There was a shite and stencil rubbish where the bed used to be. I know you think you've got the monopoly on grief, but I've had enough of that from you. I found a note I wrote to you about 3 years ago. I found a torn Durex packet. I found the tissues that we used to wipe away the years, the dried up issues of joy and sadness. And there was blood. I never thought there could be so much blood. There was handfuls of the stuff. We could measure our existences in inches of blood. There was blood on the skirting board, blood on the floor. There's been blood on my stylus for a month or more. But we sorted out the 33 and 45, and every single record was a memory. As you packed up your china, you started to cry, but I bet you don't look like you've been crying anymore. We sorted out the 33s and 45s, now I bet you don't look like you've been crying anymore. Your home packed up in cardboard boxes, spices in the record shelves where you take what was yours and possibly some of mine. And now some new friends, people I don't know, are gonna help you down the stairs and out of my life. We sorted out the 33s and 45s. Every single record was a memory. As you packed up your china, you started to cry, but I bet you don't look like you've been crying anymore. Cause time's the greatest healer, they say. Only time will tell. And if I'm deep in self-denial, I'll just say things gone very well. They're
going very well. Very, very well. This one.
What's playing on Broadway? I'll tell you what's playing on Broadway, and I'll do it by checking Performing Arts Insider. Off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, off-off-off-Broadway. You keep adding offs, they'll keep adding listings. Who's in the cast? What's it about? Is it good? Can you bring the kids? Performing Arts Insider is the theater guide. Call 516-295-1511, 516-295-1511, or go to TotalTheater.com and click on Performing Arts Insider. I've been telling you for months why you should use Hewlett Minuteman Press for all your copying and printing needs. But here's one of the owners, Mike Toron, to tell you why.
Hi, how you doing? At Minuteman Press, our ultimate goal is service. We are your best source for the most complete line of printed products. You can check us out on the web at www.hewlett.minutemanpress.com.
Yeah, this is Reckless Eric on Dave's Gone By. I think you steer, maybe you steer a fine line between banality and sort of obscure, pretentious poetry.
My God, that's this show. No.
Oh, right.
But
I also thought that there's so many newer songwriters who just work with, especially bad songwriters who work with verses and choruses, and they work with chord patterns, and they all do the same thing, and I'm thinking, this is just pollution. I wish there was another way of making music. And then a friend of mine who's a DJ in England said, the trouble with songwriting is that it gets in the way of making music. And I know exactly what. So, and I got into all the dance music thing in England.
Because because it's a group effort, because it's a band, or
after rave and everything, I got into DJ stuff, like techno,
as
you call it over here. Because it's just immediate. Those people, they go into the studio with nothing and they say, right, we're going to make a record. And they make it. And they make it happen in there. And the music is the medium. Where this whole idea of writing a collection of songs and then getting some people together to play them and teaching them all how to play them in some crummy rehearsal room, then booking a studio and playing the songs in there as best as you possibly can and then putting that out as an album doesn't really appeal to me. I think it's boring.
Wow.
And you get groups like...
Well, that's the history of...
Do you have Travis?
I rather like Travis, but okay, yes. They've had a couple of hits over
here. Although people talk about songs being well-crafted.
Yeah.
I don't want to know about well-crafted. I mean, like... I want to know about something that will fall apart in your hands. I want to know about cheap rubbish. I want to know about anything but well-crafted. People get to a certain age. They get to over the age of 35, and then they get a better job, and then they start furnishing their homes with well-made furniture. You know, they'll get a piece of, they'll get a wooden armchair kind of thing, a set of dining chairs, and say they're well-crafted. What do I want well-crafted songs for? I don't want to know about that. I want something that's tricky and devious and insulting and rancid.
That is this show.
Great. It's not a well-crafted show.
Yeah.
Now, that's much more fun to me.
Huh. Well, we're talking to the tricky and devious and occasionally rancid, reckless Eric. Dave's gone by. We do have to kind of wrap this up, but who published the book in England, by the way, in case people can get it like on Amazon or something?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it through my website as well, which, of course, is www.recklesseric.com.
Reckless with a W, recklesseric.com. And if you're looking for the author of the book, it's Eric Goulden, G-O-U-L-D-E-N.
Yeah. And it's called A Dysfunctional Success.
I guess the closing question would then be, in writing the book, was there any kind of cathartic moment or something that you learned about yourself in the telling of yourself?
No, I think I've got that pretty well sorted out because I've been sober for a long time. But I did have this thing about it must be 100% honest.
And is it, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I know my sister's hardly speaking to me because I told the world about her Rolling Stones poster. She just, like, well, she was about 10 at the time. She was a little bit older than me, and she labelled them up. She couldn't remember their names, so she labelled them on this Rolling Stones Fabulous 2-8 poster, Blondie, Curly, Toothy, Charlie, and the other one.
Well, okay, maybe the other one would have been a little upset.
Blondie, I think, was Brian Jones. Toothy was
Cliff Richards. Well, that would work, yeah.
Cliff Richard.
Mouthy, I guess, would be,
Blondie, Curly, Toothy. Curly, I can't remember who Curly was now.
Maybe Bill Wyman.
Blondie, Curly, Toothy, Charlie. No, the other one was probably...
What would Mick have been called? Probably Lippy or something. Or
I think he was actually Toofy, come to think of it, because he was grinning, because he was the lead singer.
Right, and he had that goat sort of thing going on, probably, yeah. So this is the worst thing she's holding you against?
Yeah, well, I said that I was about 9 or 10 at the time, and she was about 11 or whatever, and I said in the book I was beginning to understand that she'd somehow missed the point. she's very angry about that. But I say, well, that's why I became a rock and roll star and you became a chartered accountant.
Well, we are here with rock and roll star, legitimately.
I'm not really a rock and roll star. I was a rock and roll star for about 2 minutes in 1979.
All right, semi-legend, twice removed, Reckless Eric. And I thank you so much for joining us in the neighborhood.
Thank you.
WGBB, the place for you and me. We're one big family. And let me make one thing clear. There's so many shows to hear, like Joyce Keller, the radio psychic. Wednesdays, 11 p.m., she's one fine uncanny chick. And Fridays at 6, if you can't get a date, there's Bonnie D. Graham telling you how to mate. Saturday nights, the Mikey and Jimmy show. For rock and roll comedy, the place to go. And make sure to listen on Sundays, too. At 7 p.m., it's Joe Salzo's Worldview. So many programs on 1240 a.m. If you had half a brain, you tune in to them. Yes, WGBB is the place to listen all week long. Joyce Keller, Wednesdays at 11, Long Island's Dating with Bonnie D. Graham. Friday nights at 6, and Politics on Worldview with Joe Saldo, Sundays at 7. So if you love Dave's Gone By, give these other shows a try. They serve your community. If you listen, you'll know why.
What do the letters DFSX stand for? They stand for Dave's Gone By, that's what, because DFSXRadio.com is rebroadcasting vintage episodes of Dave's Gone By every Thursday night at 8 and 11 Eastern Time. So you hear me on GBB and then listen to me on DFSXRadio.com every Thursday night at 8 and 11. It's all the Dave you could ever want, kinda. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Thursday, May 12th, 2005. If you'd like a copy of this program or any previous show on CD, please visit davesgoneby.com. The more you buy, the cheaper they get. And davesgoneby.com is also the place to find out about my book of plays, Marriage Babies and the End of the World, and also how to advertise and help sponsor this program, just like our good friends at Hewlett Minuteman Press and at Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. Remember, Dave's Gone By listeners get 10% off from both sponsors. Also, go to my website if you want to hear more Dave's Gone By tonight, because older episodes of the show are rebroadcast on Live365.com thanks to the good folks at DFSX Radio. Shows air at 8 and 11 Eastern. Just click on the link on davesgoneby.com to listen in. And do come back here to WGBB AM 1240 at 9 for Filler Up, an hour of eclectic music hosted by yours truly. Special thanks, as always, to Program Director Tom Ross and to my sweet and svelte wife, Joyce. And thank you most of all this week to Eric Goulden. This was certainly up there with my all-time favorite interviews on the show. So petition your bookstore to order his autobiography, A Dysfunctional Success, and order Reckless Eric's CD, Bungalow High, and that's High Like Hello, H-I. And no, Eric isn't making the same kind of music he did in 1976. Bungalow High is more experimental and electronic, but also with recognizable elements of punk and folk and dance music. And just like the man, it's clever, offbeat, and very much doing its own thing. And that concludes me doing my own thing for this week, but Dave's Gone By will be back next week with a whole new thing. We'll go out with some older Eric, and I'll see you again for episode number 128 next Thursday, 7 p.m., May 19th. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night, love more, and wreck less, and gone by.
On a convenient sleep by the lavatory in the stadium grass. Wish to wait for the bus in a passionate clutch and go as far as we can. Do you remember when I passed my driving test? Took you to the pictures. Looking ever so fresh, the Bohemian dream you set by.